This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Mark Moffat has somehow managed to attract the world's attention for things he's passionate about, like ants. You have perhaps seen him on TV chatting with Stephen Colbert about bugs, and he makes it interesting. He has now written a new book. It's called The Human Swarm, in which he explores how humans and animals form into groups to survive and to thrive. Mark Moffat, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Awesome to be here.
Very interesting life that you led as a young man, and a young man who, you might say, didn't really fit into the human swarm, but you found your way into studying animals and got a degree in biology. And yet now, I think it's because of your work with animals and bugs, ants, that you're writing this book about our societies in general, how we're similar and different as humans.
Well, Lynn, I've spent a long time growing up, you know, hiding away in the backwoods, catching snakes and crawdads and whatnot. And as typical of such a young person, I ended up comfortable in unusual places, and I found ways of exploring other parts of the world. And I'm an escape artist now, so I go to remote places and hang out. But at the same time, I met all kinds of interesting tribal peoples and got to think a lot about how humans and animals kind of form their identities and keep groups together, like societies.
One thing that was interesting to me, you say that, well, humans are, we establish our identity in a somewhat different way than animals do. And you talked about how a human can walk into a crowded cafe with scores of other people sitting there, and they're not affected by that. And I immediately thought of my dog, Oscar. Oscar could never walk into a crowded room full of dogs and just do his own thing.
No, I mean, for most vertebrate animals, that would be impossible. You'd either start killing each other, run away in terror, or at least have to run up to everybody and figure out who's there and what they are and how they fit in. Humans don't have to do that. We are totally comfortable around strangers.
Mark, I just finished a book called Sapiens by Yuval Harari, and he talks about a lot about human society and how we were able to become the swarm that you're identifying in your book also, and kind of dominate other creatures on the earth. But I'm wondering if there were parallel evolutions of societies that went along with the human evolution, from being able to be in a clan or a tribe of a limited number to a larger tribe, and all the elements that went into to that with humans. And to use any other animal, you know, I would imagine at some point they evolved these social networks as well. So do you look at the comparison between the two and find common ground?
Oh, yes, there are common grounds, but in unexpected places. As I said, most vertebrates have trouble around strangers. They can't deal with it. They have to literally know everyone in their society as an individual. But there are unexpected animals that behave like us, and those include the social insects. And the social insects can live in societies of many, many strangers, in some cases millions and millions of them. And so they are the one parallel to us in the animal kingdom of societies that can basically grow to any size. Those are a certain number of ant species in particular. And they do that in ways that are rather remarkably like humans.
So what's that common element that you've identified between the human social network? And it's interesting that you call them social insects. I mean, that's kind of a great term and a way of looking at it, that obviously we use a human term to describe the insects, but that shows our intersection, I guess, of common ground.
Yeah, well, insects are not only social. It's not just being social, which is interacting and be in a positive way with other individuals. Animals can do that, but forming a society, which is a group with a set membership where there are insiders and outsiders, this is something we think of a lot in the study of psychology rather than biology. And the parallel comes from the fact that both ants and humans use what I call markers. We're comfortable walking into that coffee shop with people we don't know because our brains take in information really fast, and we don't even know it. But faster than the blink of an eye, you are assessing the people around you and whether you're comfortable with them. And that's based on not knowing them, but the signals that they're putting out. And those include all kinds of features that relate to their connection with us as a society. Their hairstyle, their clothing, the way they move, gesture, their language, and so forth. For ants, the signal is much, much simpler, but it's the same idea. For ants, the national emblem is a scent. It is on their body, and if you have it, you're golden. If you don't, you're in big trouble.
So I guess the obvious question in my mind is there must be some creatures that are able to process in a way and create markers, and there are some that are not able to. And is there any way, or is there anything that you've been able to arrive at that shows which creatures are able to and why, and those that are not and why they haven't been able to?
Well, the interesting thing is that markers are easy. They're very simple. It can be as simple as a flag, as long as you have the right flag. And so you think more creatures would use them. They're very handy. Having a marker means that, you know, if you're misidentified, if your friends in your society don't recognize you, they can go on the attack before they realize who you are. But if you have a big flag, if you have a call that says, "It's just me," then you're pretty safe. So the question becomes more why the social insects do it and not more mammals and birds and so forth. A couple of them do, but it's rather rare. The outcome, though, is that the societies of mammals are very small. If you think of a herd of wildebeest or a flock of birds, those aren't a society. Individuals can come and go. There's no out-group. They're in-group. It's just kind of flowing in and out freely. A society with its membership is a relatively rare thing in the animal kingdom.
If you're just joining us, our guest is biologist Mark Moffat. He's written a book called The Human Swarm, How Our Societies Arise, Thrive, and Fall. And as you talk, Mark, it makes me think about those times that I've sat in the backyard watching ants do what they do. And okay, I'll admit I get bored after about 8 minutes, but I'm wondering, you know, in an ant society, are there introverts? Are there extroverts? Are there outcasts? Are there, I'm trying to come up with the word for it, but hermits who choose to live alone, or that comparison to the variety within the human network is got to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, the thing is that ants are totally fascinating. I can watch them all day. And the reason is that they're doing a lot more interesting stuff than a chimpanzee. Chimpanzees scratch themselves, they groom each other, and they eat fruit, and they argue occasionally. But ants are building infrastructure and highways. They're working in complicated teams to bring back food. They're doing all kinds of things that we identify with. And we did that when we were infants in our backyard watching ants. And we tend to outgrow that and think it's child's play to watch ants. But in fact, we can learn all kinds of things about how large societies work, because only we and the ants have these large societies. So chimpanzees don't need a lot of things that ants need. Chimpanzees don't have to have highways and traffic rules. Ants do. Chimpanzees don't have to have complex division of labor. Ants do, just because the ants live in groups of thousands and sometimes millions. And within those groups, there's a lot more going on than you'd think, Lynn. So as you say, there are personality differences in humans, and it turns out in ants too. There are the lazy ants and hardworking ants. The hardworking ants can try to nudge the lazy ants to do more, but sometimes the lazy ants are just lazy. So there are personality differences and learning differences. So individual ants might learn how to collect a certain kind of food and get good at it and so forth. So even though they're small and small-brained, there's really a lot of interesting dynamics going on, and we're getting to know more about that.
It makes me wonder about the lack of participation in society. And, you know, if you look at the human network and human societies throughout the ages, it seems like perhaps we used to be more like ants, where it took the cooperation of an entire society to survive and thrive. And now maybe not as much, but in your research, what did you find about, you know, whether or not there were people who were outcasts millennia ago, or people who chose to live alone? Did people live alone, or could they simply not?
Well, people can live alone. It's unlikely that they're going to do that and, you know, have families and rear an entire society out of nowhere. So we're said to be obligatory in our social behavior, and that's not quite true. One of the interesting things is the idea of the superorganism, and that's this notion that the cells in the body are all linked together to form the body, and they're tightly identified with the body, and that's true of an ant colony. An ant is totally committed to its colony. It cannot become a hermit or decide to defect to Canada if it doesn't like the politics. Humans pride ourselves in our freedom, so we don't live in a superorganism. We wouldn't want to. We want to go around and do our own thing much more than an ant or a cell in a body would.
Mark, that raises the question in my mind. You talked about the comparison between ants living in a super societal network and the need to live that way in order to thrive, not only thrive, but survive, and chimpanzees who are actually less complex, even though we would look at them and we would think, you know, we would observe them as being more complex, but they have simplistic needs in their social network. And then you look at what has happened. They live in small clannish herds or tribes or groups, and ants and humans have gone in the opposite direction. We have multiplied in order to thrive. And is that because we've been driven toward it out of necessity, sort of the survival of the fittest, and the only way you're going to survive is by domination and by taking over? Or have we been drawn there for some reason? And I would think that maybe looking at the animal kingdom and world, you would maybe be getting to some sort of answer on that, whether it's a driver or a drawer.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And we were just fine. Humans were just fine in our small societies for a very, very long time. We lived as hunter-gatherers. We were egalitarian. There was much more fairness and sharing. These were the laws of the land around the world. And that changed as people began to find places to settle down where food was rich and they could stay in one spot. And once they did, they needed leaders and power differences and so forth. And it's only at that point that it was possible for societies to conquer each other. And the growth of societies isn't just a matter of the amount of food people had with agriculture. It actually required that societies spread out and either push aside, destroy, or conquer other societies. And the successful societies have always been conquerors throughout history, and particularly in early history. Any society more than 1,000 or 2 individuals has a history of conquest and power and domination. So that is part of the process now. And you could argue that we were doing just as well on our little societies, but the big ones destroyed most of the little ones, leaving very few behind. And so there really has been no choice. There hasn't been an it wouldn't be that there's a superior way of life. I would also, you know, like to have experienced life in one of these small, fair, egalitarian societies.
Mark, Mark, we have time for just one last question. And as you're talking, it's making me wonder about, you know, we're looking, doing so much research on unconscious and implicit bias. And from your perspective, where are we fitting in with, I mean, if you're talking about, we used to have these small societies and there was fairness and there was sharing, but as soon as we started settling in each other's territories, that's where it all changed. And so what does that say for, you know, how diverse we are, especially, you know, in countries like ours, where we have many, many societies trying to meld into one, but nevertheless, there are many different cultures and diversities within that one that we're trying to coexist in.
Oh, Lynn, well, there's another 20 minutes, I'm afraid, but I'll try to get to a little of that. And one of the answers is that all societies, even societies that look more homogeneous, like China, are actually consist of many, many groups that were conquered. It was just that happened centuries ago in their case. And the fact that those groups can be integrated in one society is unique to our species. No other animal has anything close to an ethnic group in their societies. And that is a product of the way that we can modify our identities to accommodate each other. And we do that to a degree. So, you know, an Ethiopian person becoming a citizen of the United States will take on many of the traits of a citizen, but they still retain a lot of their heritage. And this yin and yang of being with us and being different is certainly the challenge of societies today, and it's unlike anything you see in any other animal.
The book is The Human Swarm, How Our Societies Arise, Thrive, and Fall, and our guest is biologist Mark Moffat. Oh, Mark, you might be hearing from us again. You may become our go-to person. We've got your number.
Anything you need to know.
Yes, I have.
If you want to disappear to any country around the world, I know the way.
It sounds like it. And is it true that you were married on, where was it, Easter Island or somewhere? That the photo, was that really you that I saw?
Oh, well, yes. Melissa and I were on a research expedition to Easter Island with a fellow who was the sole survivor of Thor Heyerdahl's Tonkiki raft trip, famous in Easter Island, and they decided to we should have a traditional marriage there, and the governor of the island arranged it. So we were stripped naked at the top of a volcano, and a new peril put on.
That's great, Mark. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
A pleasure. Thanks to both of you.
All right. Bye bye.